show.
Don't make me say it's so hot right now.
Tan caliente ahora!
Your weekly dose of arts and culture.
And all of that sort of stuff.
It's that weird thing that they're classics because they're classics because they're classics, and then they become the classics and everyone wants to do the classics because they're classics.
He's amazing.
Well, you need a lot of room for all that blood.
And he's hot as a firecracker.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now. You better not use me saying that.
Amazing babes.
On 2SER 107.3.
Good morning and welcome to So Hot Right Now. My name is Nicole Beck and I will be with you here in the studio for a whole hour worth of arts and culture. We've got another eclectic show lined up for you today. We're kicking things off with some theatre. I'll be chatting with the artistic director of Squabblogic, J. James Moody, ahead of his show at the King's Cross Theatre entitled Herringbone. It's an interesting and twisted black comedy where he plays 11 characters. So I'm looking forward to that one. We'll then travel out west to one of our favourites, Campbelltown Arts Centre. I'll be joined by curator Jasmine Keane, who will talk us through Borrowed Scenery. This is an all-female exhibition that subverts the male gaze and just removes it altogether. Then back to Sydney Festival, we'll be hearing from Amrita Heppy, who I caught up with earlier in the week, and she is an award-winning dancer and activist. I'm a huge fan of her work. And she's going to talk us through her latest work, which is also part of Sydney Festival, The Ropes. Then to finish up, we'll be chatting about Brett and Wendy, A Love Story Bound by Art. This is another Sydney Festival work that explores the life and love of iconic Australian artist Brett Whiteley. So as you can see, we've got another absolutely jam-packed show, so stay with us for the next hour. I'm going to kick things off with a track from Body Type. This is Palms. You are tuned into So Hot Right Now.
Sydney's very own local legends, The Necks, return to Sydney Opera House this summer for four mesmerising performances in the intimate Utzon Room. Innovative, unpredictable, and never the same performance twice, the Masters of Improvisation will once again demonstrate why they are regarded as one of Australia's most extraordinary live bands. Book now for The Necks, January 17 to 20 at sydneyoperahouse.com. Sponsors of 2SER.
You are tuned into So Hot Right Now on 2SER 107.3. That there was a track from Robert Wyatt, The Age of Self. Now, right now, we are talking about Herringbone, which is a dark southern gothic tale performed by only one person, despite involving 10 characters. So after a two-year hiatus, independent music theatre company Squabble Logic presents Herringbone, this hilariously disturbing Valfillin ghost story. The year is 1929, a father sees a slither of talent in his 8-year-old son and enlists a fated vaudevillian to nurture these capabilities. But it all gets a little bit messy and twisted. So on the line to tell us a bit more is co-director and star of the show, Jay James Moody. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
Good morning. I'm really well. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So in Herringbone, you play 10 characters.
That's right.
Yeah, that sounds very overwhelming. Can you talk us through that experience?
Yeah, we're at our last rehearsal day today, and I'm potentially feeling a little bit overwhelmed as we go into this last run through before we head to the theatre. But it has been a lot of fun too.
So who are all these people that you are playing?
Well, the story's told from the point of view of a character called George Herringbone, and he's, you know, in his late 30s, but when he was 8 years old, he had a very, very disturbing year where he was possessed by the spirit of an old entertainer who wanted to get revenge on the guy that killed him and stage a bit of a comeback. And so I play George Herringbone, and I play his whole family, his mother, his father, his grandmother. I play the spirit inside of him. I play his mentor. I play the mentor's manservant. I play a lawyer. I play a tailor. And I play a naive woman who is in love with the spirit that resides inside the 8-year-old boy. So pretty straightforward.
Yeah, wow. I can't even fathom doing anything close to that. Is Herringbone usually performed as a one-person show, or is that just your take?
Yeah, it was originally written just as a play, but I believe it was intended to always be a one-person show. The character is a little bit schizophrenic and a little bit dissociative, and there's some question in the show as to whether any of the story actually happened or whether he just sort of has all of these personalities within him. And then in the early 80s, they turned the play into a musical, so they added a bunch of songs. And so I've got the characters that I play and a whole bunch of songs that I've got to do as those characters as well.
Right. Wow. You're so busy.
Yeah, very busy.
One thing that I love about this story is this kind of like showbiz arch nemesis revenge narrative.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, which is quite funny and current, kind of reminds me of like Dance Moms and Toddlers in Tiaras. And
there's a little bit of that in there. I mean, it's 1920s, but you know, he has showbiz parents, this little boy who isn't really very talented, but when this performer sort of takes residence inside his body, he starts to perform a bit better. And so, they're stuck in the Great Depression. The family's really poor and in dire straits. And so they see their son as an opportunity to make some money. So he's definitely sort of pushed into show business against his will.
And can you talk us through, you said it's a musical, so what's the mm-hmm. sound design like here?
Well, we've got, it's got a small band. So we've got piano, double bass and percussion and drums. And it's very sort of vaudevillian style music. So it's quite sort of 1920s sort of razzle dazzle, but in this kind of very twisted, dark sort of way. So it's kind of musical theatre, but with the dark edge.
Great. And so I wanted to know, so you're the artistic director of Squabblogic.
Yep.
So why did you choose Herringbone as your return show after, I think, a 2-year hiatus?
Well, yeah, it's been about 2 years since our last major show, which is a fairly big one. And I just wanted to come back and start with something kind of small and intimate. I just spent 14 months in Melbourne doing the Book of Mormon down there. And that's a very big sort of commercial, huge show. But, you know, my passion is for sort of more intimate storytelling. And so Herringbone was kind of the smallest show that I could think of that was also a unique story, a unique night at the theatre, something different that people may not have seen before. And, you know, I could cram a lot into just a one-person show.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I look forward to seeing it. Thank you so much for having us. For letting us have you.
Oh, my pleasure. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you. That was J. James Moody, the co-director and only actor in Herringbone. You can catch the show at the King's Cross Theatre from the 18th of January until Feb 2nd. We'll put all the details up on our show page if you want to grab some tickets to that. Right now, I'm going to take a track from Illingsworth. This is Kings. You are tuned into So Hot Right Now.
I cannot tell you where the fatal point lies. I never allow myself to read the scroll, for fear I might someday be tempted to use the forbidden knowledge.
It could be anywhere, then.
Yes, on a hand, an arm, a leg. Even a simple defensive block could mean doom.
I love to hear him play, body, and sound good to me. Should sound good to you. I love to hear him play, body, and hold it to me. Should sound good to you. I love to hear him play, body, and sound good to know you know. I love to hear him play, body, and hold it to me. Should sound good to turn it on the record. I just stopped right there. Sounded like a when I first heard it on the record. I just stopped. Right there, sounded like a when I first heard it on the record. I just stopped. Right there, sounded like a when I first heard it on the record. I just stopped. Right there, sounded like a should sound good to you.
I love to hear him play, body and sound good to me, just send it to you. I love to hear him play, body and hold it to me, just send it to you. I love to hear him play, body and sound good to know you know. I love to hear him play, body and hold it to me, just send it to. Turn it on the record, I just stopped right there. Sounded like a, when I first heard it on the record, I just stopped right there. Sounded like a, when I first heard it on the record, I just stopped right there. Sounded like a, when I first heard it on the record, I just stopped right there. Sounded like a, just send it to you. I love to hear him play, body and sound it to me, just send it to you. I love to hear him play, body and hold it to me, just send it to you. I love to hear him play, body and sound it to know you know. I love to hear him play, body and hold it to me, just send it to you.
You're going to find someone who loves you and needs you.
Right here on 2SER 107.3.
We love listeners.
You are tuned into So Hot Right Now on 2SER. I am with you for about another 45 minutes on your Saturday morning. And up next, we're talking about an all-female exhibition opening up in Sydney's West, and it's about stepping out of the male gaze and out of the frame pretty much altogether. We'll be hearing from the curator later on the show, or very soon. Her name is Jasmine Keane, and she'll be here to tell us all about borrowed scenery. But right now, this is a note from our sponsors to SCR.
Partners at Head On Photo Festival are calling out for entries across all their competition categories. Anyone with a phone can enter the mobile category, and students from K to 12 can enter the student category. And there's a $60,000 prize pool up for grabs. Head On looks for the best professional and up-and-coming photographers and takes place right here in Sydney in May 2019. For more info, head to headon.com.au. 2SER is a media partner of Head On Photo Festival.
Borrowed Scenery is an exhibition that explores what happens when women step away from the traditional male gaze and assert their own vision of the world. It features some of Australia's most renowned female artists like Tracy Moffat, Deborah Kelly and Joan Ross. We're joined on the phone by Jasmine Keane, the curator, to talk more about the exhibition. Good morning, Jasmine.
Good morning. How are you?
Great, thank you. How are you?
That's great. I'm very well, thanks. And thanks for having me on this morning.
Thanks for joining us. Can you start by explaining the title of the exhibition, Borrowed Scenery?
Sure. So Borrowed Scenery is a collection show which is happening in Campbelltown to launch our 2019 program. Borrowed Scenery, the title itself, brings forward, as you just mentioned before, into light the importance of what happens, you know, when women step into the mainframe of the picture. So for, you know, used through traditional art history, as we've known, it's been basically males inserting their vision, so looking at the female as an object. And when we take, you know, that away and put the female not as the object but as the creator of the work, that's what we're looking at here, and really celebrating the work that we've got on display from the collection.
Thinking about the work, one of the intentions of Borrowed Scenery is to shed light on the significance and influence of individual practice. So why did you choose to explore the subject matter specifically through this lens?
I think it was really important, particularly at the moment with, you know, all of the movements and the conversations that are happening with the disparity that is occurring right across our society, but especially in arts, to have this conversation and to really bring forward the works that we have from the collection, which are by women artists. So by being able to display them all in a big group like this, we can, you know, really push this conversation forward and get people really looking at it, you know, at the forefront, rather than just maybe thinking about, oh yeah, it's an issue that's going on, but actually like bring it forward and pushing it through, and then people can come through and have a look at these incredible works that we've got on display, which is 52 works from the collection. We've looked at a wide range of practices. So we've got works from circa 1900, which are floral-based works, right through till today. So we've got a cross-section of practice for people to see too.
And so Borrowed Scenery explores the discourses of female representation within collections and exhibitions. I just wanted to ask, at the moment, what is it like if you're female or non-binary artist to exhibit in Sydney? What are these discourses?
I think that it's interesting at the moment. There's quite a few exhibitions which are happening, and I think that there will be more in 2019, which are all female shows. I think that it's really important for us to look back at traditional collecting practices and the art marketplace, and see that it's been swamped with male artists, and works by male artists are, you know, more prevalent than female artists, which in turn, when we're collecting as an organisation and then we've got works from a collection to show, we've got more works by male artists than female artists. So I'm not an artist myself, but as somebody that manages the collection, I can see that there is a disparity that exists there, and that's one of the reasons why we thought it would be a really good time to bring forward some of the amazing works that we've got to show that there is a disparity there, and what are we going to do about it as an institution, rather than sit back and keep collecting as we have in the past, knowing that there's more works by male artists to collect. What can we do as an organisation to, you know, as Campbelltown Arts Centre in particular, but all organisations, what can we do to try to address that disparity that exists there?
Have you had any backlash from this movement? I think we may have lost her. Ooh, I'll just pop on a track and we'll get her right back. One second. We've got Jasmine back again. Welcome back, Jasmine.
Hi, that was an interesting timing to be cut off when we're talking about backlash.
Yeah, very interesting. What were you up to?
I was just saying I would, you know, so the show's on until March. It's only just been put up. I would be really interested to see if there is any backlash and to be able to have those conversations with people on, you know, if there could be a possible reason for it.
And how has Campbelltown Arts Centre responded to the work that you're doing?
So I work at Campbelltown Arts Centre. I'm the collections officer there. We've put on this show. Our director, Michael D'Agostino, was incredibly supportive of this show. He saw that it was really important to be able to highlight this too. We're really conscious of our programming to make sure that we do look across and see that we have got a gender balance when we're programming, and I think that even more it's important to probably try to address the disparity that's existed in the past by presenting more female shows at the moment. So I've had a very supportive response from the Art Centre and the staff, and so far the visitors. We've had a really busy couple of weeks since we've opened, so yeah, we'll see what, you know, the response is like in the future, especially leading up to the International Women's Day on March the 8th. When we'll do our closing event, and yeah, we'll see what conversations come out of it and if there's some policy changes we can make because of the show and because of our findings.
Definitely. And following on from that, you're doing a Countess report. Can you explain what that is to our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So the Countess report is a group. I suppose you could call it an organisation if you like, although I'm not sure how they would feel about being called that. It was started by Elvis Richardson quite a long time ago, and it started off as a blog on the internet. And what Elvis did was she went out and she, you know, in her own time, found sort of like looked across the art sector and looked into institutions and art prizes and female representation in the arts and pulled together some stats. So she's looking at it from a data-centric feminist lens. And so we decided as part of this exhibition that it was important not to just to do an all-female, like a tokenistic all-female show, but to try to, you know, as I said before, look at what changes we could make into our policies and our practices if they needed to be made, to try to, you know, have a more equal balance of gender, particularly in the collection. So we brought Countess on board and commissioned them to do an artwork as part of the show. And the artwork would be created by Countess reflecting on some of the findings that they researched when looking into our archives and our collection and some stats that they would find, some keywords. And it's a beautiful mix of poetry and statistic, which spreads throughout the gallery space. So, you know, they came in and they looked through all of our archives. I took them through and I was really open and tried to open up as much as possible to them to be able to look at and to count. So they've counted us as an organisation and they've found some findings about the about our collection. They've looked at our program and found some stats about that too and looked at sort of the average value of female created, like works created by female artists compared to male artists, acquisition process, and, you know, obviously like the bare number of male artists compared to female artists within the collection and works by male artists compared to female artists in the collection. So it's been a really interesting process working with them to do this. And in return, hopefully we'll be able to take those hardcore figures that we've got and change that, the policies and our practices, you know, using that as a base point because you can't really argue with numbers.
Definitely. Well, it sounds like a wonderful exhibition and I really hope some change is created as a result of Borrowed Scenery.
Well, yeah, I hope so too.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
No problem.
Okay.
The exhibition will be held on the 10th of March, until the 10th of March at Campbelltown Arts Centre. But on the 8th of March, as Jasmine mentioned, there's an official closing event coinciding with International Women's Day. So be sure to check it out at the Campbelltown Arts Centre. We'll post all the details up on our show page after this. Up next, you're going to hear from Amrit Heppy about The Ropes. This is So Hot Right Now. Stay with us.
The shells on the oval have all dried up. Cactuses and shrubs have lost all hope. Sign of moisture. Most people give their right arm for the taste of water. We'll have to call in one of the senior stock men to restore order. Because it's hard.
a track from Lobster Man, Hard a Lambie Winter. You are tuned into So Hot Right Now on 2SER 107.3. Thank you for bearing with me through those interesting technical difficulties, but we're here and we're still going, and we're kicking things off again at the half hour with some more Sydney Festival stuff. We're talking all about Amrita Heppy and Adrian Piper's work, The Ropes. So building upon a rich history of weaving and skipping, dancer and activist Amrita Heppy has created a newly commissioned video installation. The Ropes explores cultural resilience and continuity through dance, gesture, video and performance. Amrita's work is showcased alongside a selection of videos from award-winning conceptual artist and philosopher Adrian Piper. I spoke with Amrita ahead of the exhibition all about the work and what's to be expected. Can you start by talking us through the imagery of Ropes?
So The Ropes is a dual exhibition between myself and Adrian Piper. And I guess for me, it started off as an exploration into, I guess I was interested in skipping and weaving and these two practices from a personal background and personal history with it. And it then expanded out into looking at a history of skipping and a history of weaving. And then putting it together in a video, which ends up kind of being this video that builds in pace and in rhythm and almost ends up being like a video weave. And it kind of explores both of these dual histories and the intricacies within them.
And do these histories overlap?
Well, for me, I guess it was like, for me, it was, there was a few intertwining moments with it, and it was the practice of weaving from the matriarchal side of my family. So there's been a long history of it. And then also to the practice of skipping from my grandmother and how it was used as a way to disguise language in certain skipping games on a mission in northern New South Wales. So, and then I kind of dug in a little bit further and ended up finding that the history of weaving, even through like ancient Greek, was something that was kind of relegated for women, but that has been kind of the backbone of a lot of First Nations communities in terms of legacy. And then, of course, I mean, throughout my practice, I've always had an interest in the use of objects within choreography. So then further went into kind of looking at the rhythms and the almost kind of, I guess it's almost like a kind of passionate, but focused physicality that happens within skipping. And these two started to overlap for me. And so there was this almost kind of, I guess, the thread was between the choreography around weaving and the choreography around skipping, and I guess the social things and how these kind of improvisational techniques have then formed communities of their own. Yeah.
I love all your puns. Weaving, the threading. So this work explores the dualities that exist between personal dance narratives and objects as that inform them, as you mentioned. So could you maybe talk us through specific stories or objects that...
Yeah. So throughout my practice, there's always been a focus on creating, I guess, an allegory. So people will be able to have a way in that doesn't necessarily point to a set narrative. So it means that through using different objects, I've been able to place the body beside them in a way that people might be able to consider the object in a different vein. So for this, I think it's really been using the rope as the allegory. And the rope, I mean, a piece of rope has so many different access points in terms of history, in terms of restraint, control. And so it was really finding different ways to use rope within choreography, but more so within a video work that then opens up the history of how rope and skipping and weaving has been used throughout history. So within these personal narratives, I guess it was really looking at First Nations experiences of rope and of weaving and different choreographic practices around these. But then... And that's also to my own personal experience. But then I guess it's expanding bigger because the video itself then ends up being a bit of a weave of, yeah, these kind of personal stories. But then within the personal, there's, I guess, a touch of the universal.
I'm interested in, so obviously you've utilize the video form. How has that transformed the work, like, compared to just like a performance? Because it is dance based.
The video came from a residency that I did within the Smithsonian. Smithsonian, and most of the footage is actually footage that isn't of me. So there's a few bits of footage that are from my family and myself, but a lot of the footage is then found from archival footage of different people. So it's been pieced together. So in that way, the choreography of the video is very, very different to the choreography of the performance, because it's not necessarily just a straight-on video of me performing.
Yeah.
It has different archive footage from hundreds of different timelines and years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so what does the performance entail?
So the performance is using different it's a few different readings from people and their interactions with rope and with weaving, and then looking at how that object is then used with different performers. So I think we're going to be rescheduling that further along in the festival and in the run of the show. Yeah.
Great. Then I can see it.
Yes. Yeah.
How was it working with Adrian Piper?
Well, we didn't necessarily work together. We're kind of being placed alongside each other. I really admire her work. I think she's a real pioneer in terms of conceptual art, and especially with stuff that deals with race and with racial passing, which is something that's been an interest of mine. And so, yeah, it's a real honour. I mean, she really has been, I mean, she's been making art since the 1970s, and with issues that are still so prevalent today, and really, like, pointed and considered stuff. So it's really amazing to be showing alongside her. Yeah.
What do you think viewers will get out of seeing your works in conjunction? Do you think there's new things to be found?
I hope so. Yeah. I really think that there's something to be said about placing both of us together when considering different histories. And I think that while Adrian Piper's MO is to deal with African American history, I hope that by placing these two works beside each other, that we can see the difference between Black histories in America and, I guess, the greater West and imperial thing, and then Black histories in Australasia and the Pacific, and these kind of the different narratives that are coming out from both of these, even though there are similarities, but two, they're like intrinsic differences.
That there is Amrita Heppy speaking about the ropes. You can catch the work at Simon Fondue for Sydney Festival until February 24th. You can head down there and see Adrian Piper's work as well for free. There's also a performance and a workshop, so we'll put all the details up for that on our show page. Just search for So Hot Right Now on the 2SCR website. Up next, I'm chatting with the director of Brett and Wendy, A Love Story Bound by Art. This is a brand new work out of Riverside Theatres, which explores Brett Whiteley's life and love for his wife, Wendy. So stay tuned. That is coming up next.
Hi, I'm Craig Donarski, director of Casula Powerhouse Art Centre in Liverpool, and we've got a special Sydney Festival show for you. On the 12th and 13th of January, Suppression Dam. Ensemble Offspring joins the International Contemporary Ensemble from New York and Ensemble Adapter from Berlin for a surround sound concert in our Turbine Hall. They'll be performing The Dam by Kate Moore and Cleave by Natasha Anderson, and that will follow You in the Audience Choir by Alice Chance. Bellbird will be open for meals and drinks before and after the show, and you can see this and lots more at casulapowerhouse.com.
Great, great new sounding music, so definitely stay tuned. This is your place to be.
107.3
2SER.
It may as well have been forgotten, or did it simply slip your mind? Is that my heart there splitting open? I guess it just fell to the side. I've tried my best to keep you smiling, love. Maybe it's been all in vain, but I would try a million times, my dear. Tell me, would you do the same? One could say it's complicated, love, like nothing they've seen before, or simply that it is a thought we share, forever it must be ignored. If you really love me, there's no way to tell. I'm always arriving when you say farewell. In all
It's a beautiful track there from Angel Olsen, May as well. You are tuned into So Hot Right Now, 107.3. We've got one more story for you, and it is Brett and Wendy, a love story bound by art. Many iconic artists in the 60s had a few things going. One, a muse. Two, affiliations with the legendary Chelsea Hotel in New York. And three, a pending struggle with their identity and how to express that on canvas. Australian artist Brett Whiteley was no exception. The tale of Whiteley's relationship with art and the love for his wife, Wendy, is being adapted in a play by Riverside Theatres and Theatre of Image. Right now, I'm joined by Kim Carpenter on the line to tell us about the show. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
So I guess all the artists that have made an impression on Australian art history, why did you choose Brett Whiteley?
Oh, well, that was easy because his life and work run in parallel. His life was full of peaks and valleys. It was turbulent, it was dramatic and colourful and entertaining. And so not only is his artwork indelible, so was his life. And he is constantly still in the news. And so I felt that it was the obvious choice to choose Brett as the iconic artist.
I'm interested in knowing what was so special about Brett and Wendy's bond that it was worth exploring.
Well, Wendy gave up her own art career for Brett's to begin with. It was always said initially by other people that Wendy's work and Wendy's drawing in particular was better than Brett's, and he really worked at it, whereas hers came more easily. So that, in a sense, is pretty a pretty extraordinary sacrifice to make, to actually give up your own potential career for your partner or husband. And so, therefore, there was an automatic synergy because they spoke the same language in terms of their appreciation and understanding of art from the time they went to Europe and looked at the famous paintings in the big galleries in Florence and Italy and then went on to live in London. So, you know, he was, they met when she was 15 and he was 17. And so it was a very long-term partnership and as lovers, as friends, as confidants, and as his muse.
You said they met when they were 15, when Wendy was 15. How did they meet? It's incredibly
young.
They
met through a drawing studio where they were both attending a drawing studio. And so that's where they first met, and they'd meet for coffee in what was then a bohemian coffee shop in Rose Street in Sydney. And it was pretty instant.
You said that action. Wendy kind of sacrificed her practice in their relationship. Is there a sense of loss explored in the play for her artistic development?
Well, her artistic expression, it was realised through the fact that she helped him, not just psychologically, but physically in setting up still lives, of arranging the world that he lived in and worked in. So she was very good at creating an environment, an atmosphere. And, I mean, there's a line in the piece that Wendy's art is herself. And it's the way she dresses, the way she creates her own home in terms of the interior design. And the garden, of course, today is also her own creation. It's an expression of that comes from her and her taste and her aesthetic.
They've spent some time as a couple at the Chelsea Hotel in New York, where other residents include Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe. Can you explain or elaborate on their time there?
Well, that was a pretty hot, frenetic time in New York, because it was 1967 and 1968. They lived at the Chelsea Hotel. And Janis Joplin was their babysitter. Jimi Hendrix was there. There were an enormous number of writers, artists, singers, musicians. So it was a hothouse for artists. But outside those four walls, there were street protests about the Vietnam War. So there was all the anti-war sentiment going on. There was a lot of rage and unsettlement in the streets of New York and in the general sort of psyche of New York at that time. So that was impending on this sanctuary world of the Chelsea Hotel. And so, you know, there were the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy at that time. And in a sense, you look at America now, and it's just a reflection of what was happening then, in a sense. It's the violence of America that seems to be in the American DNA. And so Brett created The American Dream, which is an 18-panel masterwork. And that was his first sense of disappointment and abandonment when it was rejected by the New York art dealers, because it was just all too much for them. And in a way, he was telling them the truth, but they just didn't want to know it. And so that's when they fled to Lavender Bay.
You mentioned that he had his Brett had his first experience of disappointment with the rejection of his artwork. Is that a theme that comes up over his life story?
Sorry, I didn't catch that, because someone just banged a door here.
Yeah, no problem. You mentioned that Brett experienced his first kind of time of disappointment. Is that a part of his life story that comes up time and time again?
Yes, it is. The sense of struggle is always there. And I think that underpins all independent artists' work, where you go into an empty space and there's an empty white canvas there, and you approach it, and often with fear, until you make the first mark. And once you feel the sometimes divine intervention enters into it, you take off. And so that is portrayed in the Brett and Wendy in the theatre production through dancers, live music, as well as actors. The actors portray the characters of Brett and Wendy, Brett's sister, Franny Hopkirk, Brett's mother and father, Beryl and Clem Whiteley, and other characters. But the dancers represent the internal world of Brett. So they are the line, the shape, the form, the texture of his paintings. So dance, which is an abstract medium, sort of equates with all those qualities that go to make up a painting, you know, colour, texture, form, etc.
Wonderful. So Peter Kennard is doing the score for the show. Can you talk us through what we can expect from the music?
Well, there's musical references and musical homages to music of the time that reflects the period, whether it's the 50s with Teresa Brewer or Cole Porter, which is more reflection of the parents' 1950s world in Longaville in Sydney, and Brett's childhood, through to the 60s and the popular music of the 60s, such as David Bowie, etc. And then, you know, the music reflects this homages to popular music, but then Peter has created a score that is his, and that is very, as it references these iconic pieces of music and interprets them in his way, that it's able to be realised by dancers and actors on stage. So there's a soundtrack that runs throughout the whole piece, and it's an underscore as well as taking full flight at times.
Wonderful. Well, that's probably about all we've got time for. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Kim.
Okay, thanks very much.
Kim, that was Kim Carpenter, the director of Brett and Wendy, A Love Story, Bound by Art there. The tale comes to life at the Riverside Theatres from the 18th to the 27th of January as part of Sydney Festival. We'll put all the details up on our show page so you can buy tickets to that one. Right now I'm going to take a track from Parquet Courts. This is Black and White.
My mind has just been blown.
2SCR.com.
You are tuned into So Hot Right Now on 2SCR 107.3 with myself, Nicole Beck. We're just about out of time. If you wanted to listen back to anything that we've spoken about today, we put all the podcasts up on our show page if you look for So Hot Right Now on the 2SCR website. You can find links to tickets. We also do a weekly wrap-up of all the cool events happening in Sydney throughout the week, so you can check that out and basically find all things arts and culture that you might possibly need. I'm going to leave you with a track from Caliucci's. Shout out to anyone who saw her last night. It was absolutely amazing, and I couldn't help myself. This is After the Storm featuring Tyler, the Creator. Thank you so much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your Saturday.
Whatever goes around eventually comes back to you. So you gotta be careful, baby, and look both ways before you cross my mind.
To my Randy, now let's produce some thrillers. My chocolate with your vanilla,
The sun will come out.